Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we're heading west in the company of someone I've wanted to talk to since the pioneer days of this podcast. Victor Laval is one of those authors who seems to exist in another realm entire. He pops in now and again to see the rest of us mere mortals and drop a new book at our feet. In 2016 he did it with The Ballad of Black Tom, putting the boot into Lovecraft in the process, yay. And in 2018, he charmed us all with The Changeling. Now, a whole pandemic later, he's back with his newest novel, Lone Women. And I'm delighted to say it's a weird western, one of my favourite subgenres of them all. We talk about homesteading and taming the wilderness, about family and fidelity to truth and the need for happy endings. And there's an awful lot of chat about monsters. And I know that I do say that most weeks, but trust me, this is a very special monster. In fact, it's a very special conversation, one of my favourite ever on Talking Scared, and that's saying something because there have been quite a few by now. But if you want even more Talking Scared, some of you already know what to do, but for everyone else, you can sign up for Patreon to hear extra chat with the guests and some kooky deep dives into niche themes and classic books. Upcoming bonus stuff includes Mothman and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod or use the link in the show notes. Oh, and if you can, leave a review, please. Usually I say all that in the afterword, but you might not hear that. I don't know who listens that far. So if you can, yeah, leave a review. Consider it the admin for having a nice time. Okay, now, follow me to the wind-bitten plains of 1915 Montana, where the women are strong and the cowboys are dying. Let's talk scared. Well, hi, Victor, and welcome to Talking Scared.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for taking the time of what I'm sure is a very busy publication schedule. How are things going your end as we approach the day that Lone Women drops?
Yeah, things are good. I mean, so we live here in the Bronx, and by and large, the Bronx is totally unbothered by my stress, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, so it puts you in your place a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
To the community that I'm part of, a novel from you is always eagerly awaited.
Yeah.
And I hadn't realised this is your first novel-length project since 2018, I believe. Was that when The Changeling came out?
2017 in the US, 2018 I think it came out in the UK.
Right, and that was a kind of whole different world.
That was for sure.
You must be excited for people to read this book.
Thrilled. Like, I'm thrilled because I do feel like it's a real different kind of book for me. And it's a story and a history that I really want people to know about.
Well, let's jump into that. And I'm glad you said a different book, because I've got a question about that. But let's jump into the history. Let's jump into it all, because I was very ready for this book, because I love a weird Western. And Lone Women is a book that's full of weirdness and quite a few secrets. And it'll be interesting to see how we navigate those today. But the best place, as ever, to start is with you. So can you introduce my listeners to Lone Women?
For sure. So Lone Women takes place in the American West in 1915. And it's the story of a woman named Adelaide Henry, who is a daughter of a black farming family, of which there were many in Southern California at the turn of the 20th century. She's part of a black farming family there, and something terrible happens to her parents that makes her go on the run from Southern California all the way to Montana, to the northern end of Montana, where she'll stake a claim on a homestead there in some of the most desolate and hostile territory that the United States has to offer. And the only thing she brings with her is an enormous steamer trunk that is locked with a padlock, and she has to keep it locked with a padlock because anytime the padlock opens, people die.
Yeah, it's just a great elevator pitch. Much like your book, I'm going to make my listeners wait in anticipation until we talk a little bit, to whatever degree, about what's inside the trunk. Listeners, you'll have to suffer like I do. Let's start more broadly. Lone women, I mean, it's already on a lot of big lists, you know, like the books to read in 2023, books for the spring, all that kind of stuff. And not just the ones that are exclusively focused on horror. And then that got me thinking that it does feel like you are one of those writers who can write about horrible, weird, magical things and yet not be pigeonholed as a horror writer. So to start, how do you see your relationship with this genre?
Well, I'm a person who grew up on horror for sure. And in a way, I think one of the things for me, part of my progression as a writer has been that I began as a, for whatever this means, a literary writer or a literary realist writer. My first two books, they might have some weirdness in them, but they are largely grounded in literary realism. You know, late 20th century, people growing up in where I grew up in Queens, New York, kind of stories. And then with my third book, Big Machine, is when I kind of pivoted. And so I do think in some ways the genre that one is sort of like put into is often almost like joining a guild. And it's like you join your guild when you're young, when you're an apprentice, and then that's your guild. Your literary realist guild, your horror guild, your sci-fi guild, your fantasy guild, romance, whatever it is, historical fiction. But of course, I don't think that, at least for myself, that the life of a writer is necessarily limited to any one thing. And so what I was saying when I started, after my third book, what I would regularly say is that I was a literary writer who was working really hard to become a horror writer.
I like that. Because generally the progression is considered to go the other way. So yes. And I mean, and like all genre fiction that's full of tropes and recurrent motifs, this show has been going long enough now that there are certain things that come up again and again and again in my work. And one of them is this refusal to get on board with the idea of literary and genre and the idea of these camps of literature and stuff. I think it is and should be one big melting pot with different offshoots, you know?
Yes.
Let's dispense with literary, because that seems to be a mark of some kind of class. And let's talk, you began with kind of social realism. And then,
yes,
because basically I'm only familiar with the latter part of your career, right? So right. I was quite surprised to find that your first few books are not genre fiction per se. And you mentioned Big Machine. I began my journey with you with The Devil in Silver. And yes, that, to my understanding, is where you first introduce the supernatural and these more overt horror tendencies. And since then, it's been, let's say, darkly speculative all the way. And was there something that changed at that point? Or was there something that hooked you in? Because it feels like a pivot point in your career.
Yeah, well, I would say so. That began with Big Machine. And I would say Big Machine has speculative elements that aren't necessarily openly horror elements, which is why I think Devil in Silver is when it's like, you know, much more clearly fully horror. But Big Machine was really the beginning of that. And essentially, what happened was I published the first two books and they were very autobiographical. The first one was a collection of stories about being a boy growing up in Queens, New York, black and Latino kids growing up in Queens, New York, parents off working all the time. So they're kind of raising themselves for better or for worse. That's the first book of stories. Then the second book, was about a black kid who goes to college, fails out because he has a mental breakdown, and his family has to come sort of save him. But then what he discovers and the reader discovers is that he's not the only one whose mind is going through some turmoil. And in fact, the whole family is in trouble, kind of idea. And honestly, like if I had written another book in that vein, the third book would have been about that black kid goes to graduate school and becomes a writer, which is a book that I wanted to spare everyone from reading, you know. But more importantly, what was happening also was like I was living in what I realize now with some space was this false idea that the way that one becomes a serious writer, we'll set aside literary, but a serious writer, is that you write about misery, and only misery is serious. And so I wrote those first two books, and I wrote about maybe the worst parts of my autobiographical story, some of the worst parts. And maybe it shouldn't be a surprise, but when I was at the end of the second book, I realized like I hated writing. It made me unhappy. Mm-hmm. I was just visiting the worst things. And so I'd said to myself at that moment, like, what would be the thing you could include in a story that would make you feel excited again? And instantly the word was monsters. If I could put some monsters in a book, I think I could enjoy myself again. And so that was the sort of the beginning of that pivot that you talked about. Like, if I'm being totally honest, like, if those first two books had either made me rich or famous, who knows? Maybe I would have said like, hey, this is working out pretty well. And I would have just stayed in that realist realm, right? But they weren't doing that. And so I said, these things should at least make me happy. You know, I should at least enjoy this thing I'm doing. And then the greatest joy of that was that when I pivoted that way, and in Big Machine, Big Machine is a story about essentially like a black secret society that is searching for the hidden voice of God. And then it kind of culminates in lots of people blowing themselves up across Oakland, California. And there's weird monsters and other things like that, like flittering in and out. And I just had a blast writing it. And the greater joy was that I found many, many more readers. When I was having fun, suddenly I found other people were enjoying the thing I was doing. Even though there was serious stuff in it, there was also the wild fun of it all. Mm-hmm. There was the monsters, all the rest. And I took that as a proof that, in fact, I was on the right path and I shouldn't leave this path. If there's often a narrative of like writing genre will keep you limited or pigeonholed, whereas writing social realism will let you reach the larger world, my experience was the exact opposite.
Isn't it funny how the minute we start writing or reading about horrible things, the words like joy come into play? Because I don't know a single horror reader who says, yeah, I read this stuff to make myself feel bad. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a thing that readers and writers seem to come to it from both sides with complete joy, despite the fact that it's about the most horrendous stuff. And I think people outside the genre looking in just don't get that. They think we're all incredibly morbid, unhappy people.
Right. Well, whereas, I mean, sometimes one of the things that baffles me is I don't understand how people who either read or watch stuff that is relentlessly sunny, right? That is that sort of minimizes the real problems of life or the sort of outsized problems of life. I never understand how they can feel satisfied with that because it's such a lie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so untrue. And one of the things that I think is so beautiful about horror is I think horror tells the truth to its readers. In a way that I appreciate.
And often it exposes the precise lie you're talking about. You know, how many things have we read about the perfect little town, you know, Stepford, yes, or like the whole setup in Get Out, or, you know, anything like that, where anything where people are happy all the time, it's innately creepy.
Yes.
And it's shown as such when all the veil is pulled back, you know? So yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I've always been very suspicious of cheerful people because I always think they must know something I don't. But one of the things you said when you were given a sort of concise summary of your work is that you talked about the character in The Ecstatic who has a kind of disordered mind. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about your work, and the one thread that seems to come pretty much all the way through is the foregrounding of mental health issues and distorted states of mind. So in The Ecstatic, your character has got potentially schizophrenia. Big Machine is about an addict. The Devil in Silver set in a psychiatric hospital. And perhaps your most lauded book, The Changeling, features postpartum depression of sorts. Mm. Is there an appeal to characters whose minds have gone off track a little?
Well, I guess maybe questions of people's like mental states is maybe the frequency that I am tuned to the most, largely because of a great deal of family history with either we call it either mental illness or neuroatypicality, mm-hmm. whatever we want to call it. That's sort of the frequency my life has been tuned to the most. I think of someone like Stephen King and how many addicts and yeah. former addicts he has in his work. And when you understand, when you know, obviously his very famous history and struggles with addiction, you kind of go, oh, okay, I get that. And it's almost like that's the frequency through which he can best understand people and their flaws, their successes and their failings. And so for me, I do think I come back regularly to this question of just like, where is someone's mind and how does that create their reality? And that's my way I understand almost everything.
Exactly that, create their reality, because all of the books I've read of yours present this kind of urban cityscape that has a very glossy real reality, and underneath it there are other things going on, and that fractured state of mind is often a kind of ideal broken prism to look it, yes. look at reality through, you know. Yeah, I find that really interesting, because it the two books that don't seem to do that are The Ballad of Black Tom and right. this new one, Lone Women, in which it feels like your protagonists have got a very clear idea of the reality they live in, as mad as it may be.
Yeah, well, so in a weird way, in both Ballad of Black Tom and in Lone Women, I felt like there was a more clear and concrete proof of like the sort of the question of a fractured mental state fractured mental state. Let's just stay with that, I guess. Rather than it being interior, it's really exterior. In Ballad of Black Tom, Tommy has this genuinely cosmic existence. Like, there's no questions of, is this real? Is this not real? It is real. And as a result, I think there was a way that he needed to be even more grounded and stable so that the reader had someone that they could sort of travel this path with, you know. And so they'll say like, okay, I trust Tommy is seeing the world in the, whether I agree with him or not, I trust the way he's talking about the world. And then when these strange things start to be introduced or happen, I kind of say, okay, that's the strange stuff. This is the stable stuff. Whereas in some of my other books, both those states are inside the character. Mm-hmm. Those ones, they're outside. And then again, with Lone Women, it's literally Adelaide and another presence, I guess I'll say, represent the same thing, right? There's one is the stable one. One is the sort of the misunderstood or the impossible one. And so in that way, again, I felt like, okay, here I need to have both these things be clearly kind of poles that we're moving between rather than just working inside one character.
Okay. Right. That makes sense to me, certainly. Yeah, they're the anchor, so to speak, for the reader
right.
in this story. Yeah. I mean, we'll get into Lone Women now, but I'll just say I could do a whole podcast just talking about Black Tom. Because I wrote a thing for Esquire a while back. I wrote I think it was the 50 greatest horror novels of all time. And I included The Ballad of Black Tom in that. Because
I'm sorry, I didn't realize that.
No, it's fine. Don't worry about it. I'll send you the link or something. But I'm not going to go on about it because I've talked about it quite recently on this show when I had Matt Ruff on the show. So I'm not going to bore listeners. But I have very complex relationships with Lovecraft. and that was the book I needed when I read it. So maybe at some point in the future, we can do a whole thing about The Ballad of Black Tom.
I would enjoy that.
Yeah, I think Lovecraft fans would not. But with all that broader context we've just set in mind, Lone Women, your newest, feels both recognisable as a Victor Laval novel and also a departure, which you alluded to right at the start. And I could witter on about how I think it fits with your back catalogue, but I'd rather hear your thoughts on how this relates to your previous work. Do you see connective tissue? Do you see the opposite of that? How does this fit?
Well, I certainly see, I'll say first, the things that don't connect is that by and large, not entirely, but by and large, I grew up in New York City. I know New York City well. The vast majority of my work, except for maybe Big Machine, is set in New York City, and I hope feels deeply grounded in that reality and understanding that reality. But after my previous novel, The Changeling, was after I wrote that, in many ways, I felt like I poured everything I could, my love, my hate, the history and all the rest of New York City that I could do. I had poured it all into that. And I really felt like, for me, I had exhausted New York as a subject for the short term, right? Like I couldn't see what else I could add or do. And so I was kind of like casting about for something different, like tell a story somewhere else. And I came across this historical book called Montana Women Homesteaders, A Field of One's Own. By a professor, a woman named Dr. Sarah Carter, who compiled all the info and wrote some stuff in it. And it was so far, in a way, like it was so distant. It's, like I said, it's about Montana in the early 1900s, and it's about the women who homesteaded that some of that land. So far away from my personal experience that I was just reading it as like someone interested in the history. I was never in any way thinking I would write about them. But the more I read about them, the more invested I became in them. And in a strange way, the sort of connection I started making was, so my mother is a Ugandan immigrant, came to New York, in the standard immigrant way, with nothing, had no one, this, started working as a secretary, and that's what she did her whole life. She's still alive, but her whole professional life. She's retired now. And I started thinking about her, and then a few years after my mom came, she brought my grandmother here, and it was the two of them. And I started seeing all these connections, or believing all these connections existed, that they were both just generations of homesteaders. Those women homesteaded the Montana Plains at the beginning of the 20th century. For me and my family, my mom and grandmother were the homesteaders in New York.
Okay.
And I started to sort of pour all my admiration and sort of awe for my mom and grandmother into these women and trying to sort of, or maybe it gave me new context for thinking about how much my grandmother and my mom were risking or trying by coming here. And that sort of made it much more, starting to feel much more personal. I was interested in the history, but now suddenly I was like, I think I see a way into understanding these women in a way that I didn't when I first started reading the history. And the more that I thought about them as analogs for my mom and grandma, the more I could close the distance, you know, in time, in location, and all the rest. And then the really big part is just one of the currents that's running, as you said, is running through all my stuff, is this question of like mental states and different versions of reality that people's minds can create. But the other thing that I regularly see floating in my work, even though I don't think it's ever that openly discussed, is the idea of like what we owe to our families, like the burden of family. And the gift of family, and in particular the caretaking of family members who are who have a hard time taking care of themselves. I certainly see it in like the Ecstatic for sure. It's there in Big Machine a little bit. It's definitely there in Devil in Silver. It's even there in Battle of Black Tom between Tommy and his dad. And that's another current that matters very much to me because of myself. And I have two siblings. One has died and one is still alive. But both dealing with a great deal of mental issues. And one of the ongoing concerns and issues for me is about caretaking, right? And about the responsibility that, for lack of any better terms, that the healthy child has for the unhealthy child. Like whether or not those terms are the right terms to use, that is often the way things are framed. The responsible child versus the irresponsible child, that kind of stuff. And so that was how I made it personal in the sense that like, okay, here's what I'm deeply invested in these questions. And in a way, by these characters being nothing like me, by the location, the time period being nothing like me, I actually found it was easier to talk about all that stuff explicitly in a way where it was usually veiled in previous books.
Yeah. And speaking about being veiled, you said a quite profound thing there about the caretaking and particularly in relation to your own family. And now that I know that, certain relationships in Lone Women take on a whole different aspect. But that steps, I think, unfairly too close to a potential spoiler to go into any more. But
yes, I agree.
I will say that when listeners who come to this having already read the book hear that, I think that will really impact the way they read the book.
Right.
Yeah, maybe. That's something I'd like to talk about more, but I don't think it would be fair to you or my listeners to go any further.
I agree.
The first point you made about, you know, the change from the city to, well, kind of like the biggest wide open space possible, Montana in the early 20th century. I wonder, did that change anything about the writing? Did that change your process or demand a different skill set? Was it harder for you?
Well, the certainly, maybe it's obvious, but the biggest change was the environment, you know, that nothing about the way I had grown up would allow me to sort of inhabit this place, right? Like sometimes, you know, one of the ways I will sometimes cheat a thing, like if I have a character who's in another city somewhere else in the world, there might be things I might extrapolate from growing up in a city that I can maybe sort of graft on. No city is the same, just like no town is the same. But maybe there are some things I can sort of include here or there that can make it feel sort of grounded and real. But I knew, I don't know anything about Montana in that period, except that I drove through that region one time before, but like long before I was thinking about writing the book. And I had enjoyed that time, but I felt like if I'm really going to inhabit this, I have to go back and I got to read a lot. I got to read a lot, you know, and see if I can find a way to let, in particular, like one of the things that's really great is a lot of the homesteading women kept journals, you know, wrote letters. And so like that book I mentioned and many other books included their letters about being out there. And so I kind of immersed myself in that stuff as much as I could so that I could try to sort of reorient my mind to just leave behind the New York kid and be in that place and be with them. And then I decided one of the other ways I'd do that is like I wouldn't overdo it in the descriptions of the places or anything like that, for fear that you just kind of go like, well, there's all the research, you know, I see all the minutia of it all.
Yeah. It's like, do you know, I've read these books.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
What kept occurring to me is for a start, I know that you kind of expanded this novel from a short story.
Like a longish story that was in an anthology called Long Hidden. And it was like speculative history stories from like new perspectives that came out, more than 10, 15 years ago.
Okay, so that was the origin. But when did you novelize this? When were you working on it?
So I wrote that story, like I'd been reading the book I mentioned, and that was the only book at that point that I'd read. And I wrote this story because this anthology request came through. And I got to the end of the story. And one of the things that was really good for me was like, I can't remember who it was. I was speaking to somebody. Maybe we did a reading for the anthology or maybe somebody read it and wrote or whatever. And they asked this really great pointed question because the story seemed to end on a for lack of better terms, like a happy note. And then somebody said to me or wrote to me, like, well, this is happy for one of the people at the end, but the other person doesn't seem like things have gotten better for them at all. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, damn it. I was so deeply invested in this one character. You know, like the happy ending for one is definitely not a happy ending for the other. So then I started thinking like, well, or like a triumphant, like working through something and coming out the other side, you know, even if happy is the wrong term. And I just couldn't, it was like kind of nagging at me like, well, what would it look like for both of them to get to a new place for each of these characters too? And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, well, you can't just tell the story of them then. Then you got to tell the story of the town. You got to tell the story of the other women. You got, you know, and rather than that feeling daunting, it felt exciting.
And when did you do that?
So let's see. So I wrote that story. And then the next thing I was working on was The Changeling. Then Bow to Black Tom. So that would have been 2016 or so when I was done with both of those. So I probably started on this book in earnest probably around 2018.
Interesting. Because I had assumed that you had moved away from the city and gone into the great wide open because of lockdown.
Ah.
That your mind had gone, I want some fresh air. Because New York seemed like ground zero for the worst of the pandemic at times. And I thought, I imagine you sitting there going like, I just want to be away from people and breathing fresh air.
Isn't that funny? You know, you're absolutely right that that would have been, I guess that, well, we would have, I would have started already and then we ran smack into COVID. And we were, it's true, like there's my wife, myself, and then we have two kids, two youngish kids. And we were in a two-bedroom apartment for the whole of COVID here in New York. We were certainly trapped. It wasn't the reason I did it, but it was a gift during that time to imagine going elsewhere and to really be like, look at all this room. And even more than the room is to be like, and they're alone. How nice is that? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's supposed to be horror, but from your perspective, God, that sounds nice.
It sounds beautiful. Even like our older son, 8 months into lockdown here or whatever it was, he just said out of the blue, he just said, I'm so sick of all of you. And we were, all of us were like, us too.
Yeah.
I wish we could get away from you. We all, and no one's feelings were hurt. We all knew it was true.
Yeah, right. I'm going to change direction of the conversation because I kind of made a bit of an informal promise to myself and my listeners to not dwell on lockdown any more than necessary because Jesus. Okay. Let's talk about the whole Western stuff and how it meets horror. So I love a weird Western, love it. But that world and non-weird Westerns, just Westerns generally, that world is usually presented as overwhelmingly white and male. Mm-hmm. You know, any women you do meet tend to be either like brothel keepers or barmaids or some kind of strange, slightly androgynous bounty hunter that we're supposed to be attracted to and creeped out by. There's a lot of tropes there with that kind of thing. But the name of your book alone suggests that you are not interested in repeating those, that kind of patriarchal view of the West. And Lone Women doesn't just introduce a black female protagonist. It also foregrounds diversity of many kinds. We've got the group of heroes include a queer female couple, one of whom is Chinese. There's also a character who identifies as another gender. And well, I mean, are you making a kind of political point with those characters? Or, as I expect, are you reflecting a reality that, as it was in the West, that we've kind of refused to acknowledge?
Yes, it's the latter for sure. Like, the other thing that was the huge draw for me to write this book, like if the history I read was exactly like what popular entertainment showed us, I wouldn't have written the book because the story would have been told. But the whole point of that original book and then the books that I dove into after was like there was absolutely a, relatively speaking, large Chinese presence in Montana at that time. There was a smaller but genuine Japanese presence, and not just the Chinese and Japanese presence was not just because of the railroad. There were people creating their own businesses, restaurateurs, certainly laundry folks. The appearance of those folks, of Chinese folks in particular, is intense enough, and the competition that they start to create toward white Americans is so great that white Americans come up with the Chinese Exclusion Act, which is the first law to make any immigrant group illegal in the United States. Right, like oftentimes you'll hear like a kind of rhetoric about like if you want to come to the United States, just do it legally. Mm-hmm. But it was the legal way to do it in the past was show up. But then when too many Chinese people started showing up and doing well, suddenly you couldn't be Chinese and come. Mm-hmm. And then that was the beginning of anytime there was any non-white group who was coming to the U.S. who started doing well. Suddenly there was a law saying, oh, wait, you shouldn't come. That history was a thing that I knew maybe tangentially. I'd heard of the Chinese Exclusion Act, but I didn't understand the reason it existed was because there were lots of Chinese folks here, and they were doing well. And so then in the book, I made a point of explicitly having a character read about an actual historical figure who essentially lived under another gender, like explicitly in a scene, mm-hmm. so that people wouldn't think me bringing up that particular idea was something I was bringing from the 21st century and inserting in the past. Like the joy of this book to me is there's literally only one thing that I made up, and it's the only impossible thing.
Yeah.
And everything else, if you follow the path of research that I did, or you follow one's own research, you will find every single thing I mentioned in here is a real thing. But that the flattening power of history as it's taught and of popular entertainment, not enough thought or conversation is given to the ways that this is almost a concerted, like this is a willful act to reduce the past into a portrait that feels comfortable to the people making that entertainment now, right? Versus what it actually was. If the past hadn't been so rich and complicated and diverse, I just wouldn't have written the book.
The Western is a particular instance as well, because, right, so for full context, I recently spoke to the writers of a book called The Black Guy Dies First.
Mm-hmm.
Robin Means Coleman and Mark Harris, and they looked at how horror has typically mistreated or maligned black representation in horror cinema. When it comes to the Western, it's even more egregious, right?
Yes.
Because unlike the horror movie, the Western purports to be the kind of ur-myth of America.
That's right.
So you're sort of taking the most central story archetype of a nation and then saying, this can only accommodate white people.
Well, and that in more recent years, one of the sort of refrains of, I would say, like more hard right, particular kind of hard right guy is like, we gave you civilization, right? We won the West for you. So just say thank you and don't talk to me about diversity and all the rest. But then when you actually go back and look at the history, you say like, well, you didn't do it alone. And then what did winning the West mean? Why would there be a deep investment in pretending that there was essentially only one mover in the wheel of time in history? And the only reason can be because it is it feels good, right? To take all the credit and the glory, and it makes one justify why one is on top now, right? If we did it all for you in the past, then that's the reason why we're on top now. Versus a different conversation, which would be there were a lot of us doing it in the past, but none of the others are still around. How did that happen? What did you do to those other people? And then you have, the state of Florida is working hard to not teach any of that history, because then you might have to say, well, your great grandpa went around and shot a bunch of people. That's what he did. He fought hard. He cleared land. He did all these great things. And then he did also kill a bunch of people because he wanted their land too. You know what I mean? And I feel like there's something healthy about just talking about all of it. But I also understand that lots of people want to protect their family names.
Yeah, but, you can take that all the way up to the Mayflower. It doesn't change shit.
I don't know. It just seems to me, like, going back to our idea of, like, horror, rather, again, versus other genres, one of the things that breaks my heart often about horror, when it is doing that conservative work, right, of, like, getting rid of people, is I always feel sad because I feel like horror is actually the genre that can talk to you about, like, these people on the Mayflower, they ran away to escape religious persecution, if that's the myth that we want to go for. And then they got here, and then they said, you all better be Christians. And you kind of go, that's interesting. that's interesting horror. And then they either murdered or Christianized everyone they met. Mm-hmm. And you sort of say, don't you think that's interesting? And I guess the only reason it's not interesting is if you still agree with that project.
Well, it's interesting because a moment ago when we were talking about the whole elements of gender in this book, mm-hmm. you were saying that you wanted to show that you weren't just dragging that back from the present into the past. Another way in which I think perhaps you do pull something back into the past in a much more beneficial way is that when we first meet this town, Big Sandy, it feels like a much more egalitarian place. Mm-hmm. Adelaide is met off the train by a very nice white woman who's very kind to her. And it seems like, oh, she's escaped the travails of post-Reconstruction racism and all of that. But of course she hasn't, because soon, once the shit hits the fan, capitalism and nepotism and protectionism start to come into play in this town. And suddenly anyone who isn't a kind of white, heteronormative American becomes suspect. And there's a scene at the end that literally becomes like a rally stroke lynching. And I, with somebody on stage, like a charismatic leader, and I couldn't help but think you're drawing direct parallels between then and now, or perhaps showing us that nothing changes.
I certainly was hoping it would be clear that, like, if the narrative is like the United States has never been more broken than today, you kind of be like, well, that's ridiculous. Right. And to say even more broadly that cultures sort of crushing those who don't fit or who aren't willing to contort to fit, whatever the mainstream narrative is, no matter where you go in the world, those folks are often expunged, killed, whatever, sent running, and that certainly isn't something that is only a 21st century problem. And in this much more small scale of this town, I wanted to say, yes, certainly those things are similar. Like, I hoped it was more like ringing a bell in the past that, as you're saying, like, that a reader could very easily say, oh, I see. I see how this talks to now. And that, certainly one of the big things I did want for the book, I didn't want it to feel like the past in this book was just stuck in the past, right? Mm-hmm. That the things that they're all wrestling with are things we are wrestling with now that will be wrestled with in another 100 years, presuming there's a planet, much of a planet left. I mean, there will be something. Even if everyone's living on one small island in the middle of the South Pacific, we'll all still find a way to be shitty. So.
Yeah, it's like you say in the book, history is simple, but the past is complicated.
That's almost like, I wondered, like, I mean, it was like, well, here's my thesis. I'm just going to say it right here more than once.
Let's leave kind of the grim social reality aside for a little bit. And let's talk about the Weird West, because the Weird West is a great subgenre for balancing historical reality against its own opposite. And it's a subgenre that I love and I clamor for more of it. And I really struggle to articulate why that part of the world at that time, that sort of 50 years from like 1870, 1860 through to like the First World War, it feels so uniquely fascinating and eerie as a setting for the fantastical. I don't know how to explain why it feels that way. Do you have, well, any feelings, any ideas about that?
Well, you know, I wonder if this analogy will make sense, but it's the analogy that pops into my head. Years and years ago, like 20 years ago, something like that, I spent a month in Iceland backpacking around. And there was one point where on the there's only one main highway that goes around the whole country, mm-hmm. the whole island. You buy a ticket. As long as you go in the same, in one direction, you can get on and get off in any town you like. And at one point I was on the bus going from one town to the next, looking out at these like lush sort of green mossy fields. But they weren't manicured lush, you know, they were like wild and beautiful and all the rest. And somebody said in passing, because it wasn't like a tour, so I don't know, maybe it was like a passenger talking to me or whatever like that. They said, like, this landscape you see out here is what, say, where you are in the U.S., in the Northeast, that's what the U.S. looked like, I don't know, a million years ago, mm-hmm. or something like that. Like, this is some of the newest sort of land mass in the grand scale of history. And so in a way, you are literally looking back in time when you look at these places, because this is what your place looked like long before humans were there, before any humans were there. And I wonder if, in a way, that period of time in the West feels something like that for the American project, right? It is in theory one of the last places where you had large groups of people theoretically remaking the world there, mm. right? Of course, the way they had to remake it is they had to kill off and expel a whole group of people who had made entire civilizations there, right? So I'm not underselling that point, but that's even part of what makes it feel like such a Big Bang sort of moment for the United States. I think it's, you know, obviously we have the founding of the United States. That's its own sort of rich, heady blend of history. But in a way, that feels like the second invention of the United States, right? And then that's an invention that turned into an entire genre.
Mm. I completely agree, because East Coast weirdness feels more recognizably European, I think.
Mm-hmm. I can see that
extra stretch into the West, just, it's like, well, there, you know, you said then about genocide. There is a reason that genocide of the Native Americans has been a metaphor in so many science fiction stories where we go to another planet and you know, fuck shit up. Like Avatar, for example, you know, is the obvious one. There's a reason that lends itself to that kind of fantastical story, because it is so egregiously nightmarish and frankly ridiculous in a way. I mean, it seems like a trivial word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, that other stretch into the West, it feels like a stretch into an alien landscape, but an alien world where there are recognizable details of industry and society. And there's a metaphor I love in your book where you talk about this tiny town being like dice dropped on a big carpet.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And I could almost see it, like this sense of like just this tiny enclave of recognizable humanity in this completely otherworldly, ginormous landscape. There's something about that that just eludes articulation for me, but it gives me a strange sort of fizzing, thrilling feeling when I read about it. I just love this subgenre.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that sense of scale is a huge part of it. Right? Like East Coast, also West Coast, any place where there are cities and even towns, I feel like you get the sense that humanity and nature potentially are kind of at parity, you know? Mm-hmm. Like a good big village like in a half wild locale in a more rural area, okay, we're at 50-50. In a city, nature is on its back foot. Human beings have kind of overrun this place. I get that. But then, yeah, the idea that you would say you're going to go to a place that you will never, ever match for scale and power. And that's where you're going to choose to like make your life, make your home, you know? And the thing that is maybe, to me, in my mind at least, sometimes shocking is paired with that, like it's at its best when there is humility involved, right? Like any culture you're talking about there, when they're talking about like what a gift it is to be out here. I can't believe that this place lets us survive here. We're so grateful to this place. I get that. Because you say you should be fucking grateful. It is amazing that you all are surviving here. But then when you have the ones where they say like, this is ours and we're going to take it over and we're going to make it, we're going to put it underfoot. That's when you kind of say like, oh, you've lost your minds to be thinking that way. But there's something powerful about that. Mm. Like that much hubris, that much ego against just all that scale, you know.
Yeah, completely. And hence like the building of the theater in Big Sandy is a emblem of that, isn't it? Just the attempt to stamp so-called society on the wild. I've made my listeners wait like the best part of an hour now before we talk about the inner folds of this story. Like the strangeness in your book takes several forms. So there are plenty of ghosts for a start, but they're not even even the focal point of the weirdness.
Right.
The real dark secret is what is hidden in an Adelaide steamer trunk. Now, I've read other interviews in which you've talked about this, but I don't want to overstep the mark. So are you happy to go as far as to use the term monster?
I would say... that is certainly what it seems to be, right?
Yes.
Like, and that for a time it is a monster.
Mm. Great answer. Tease me right over the next question, because I thought this was going to be a book. Well, first of all, I thought it's going to be like a kind of From a Buick 8 type thing where it's going to be a portal to somewhere else. And then, oh no,
right,
there's something in there. And then I thought, oh, it's a monster story. And then quite quickly after that revelation, I just felt such pity and sorrow for her. And I used the word on purpose because like so many characters in this book, you know, the monster's gender seems important.
Yes.
There's a moment in the book when you realize she has an intellect and an internal life. And it hit me with this just crushing empathy, the true horror of loneliness. And do you even think of her as a monster yourself, Victor?
No, well, so I definitely don't, but I do think that a family's narrative about a person or a culture narrative about a person, whatever it is, can turn someone into a monster, certainly. For me, part of the greatest horror of the book is that for a good portion of the book, even she would have, if there was speech, would have said, of course I'm a monster. And that's part of the heartbreak of it. Because that is a thing that has been trained into a person. That's not a thing anyone believes about themselves from birth, you know? Probably. At least I've never encountered that. Mm-hmm. I'm really happy to hear in the best writerly way that when we finally shift and you understand this is not essentially a thoughtless being, this is a being with an inner life.
Mm.
And then for that to hit so much harder to go, oh my God, that's what you know, it's one thing to say a living thing has endured terrible conditions. It's another thing, I think, a deeper thing to say, no, you have to understand this is a conscious being. And of course, you know, that happens all the time. And that's horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are, I mean, in a way, you could say that she's just another marginalized woman in this world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that certainly was the point for me. You know, and then I hoped the other part of it was like that when you finally get that revelation, it will force you, if you, for lack of a better term, liked Adelaide, it will force you to also have to reassess suddenly your thoughts about her.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And make you go, ah, shit, I got to have more complicated feelings about even her.
Yeah.
Who I hopefully was pulling for. And now I feel like, oh, you have some things to atone for.
This is why I like the character of Bertie Brown, because immediately she just goes to empathy. Immediately. Yes. And I think that's a real marker of her character.
And I've even as a writer, I felt like you needed at least one person who instantly understood how terrible this was and instantly gave their heart to her.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
The real monstrosity in the story is entirely human.
Yes.
Well, there's kind of two sides. There's a kind of genteel monster in... I won't actually mention who that is because that's still a little bit of a reveal. There's a kind of genteel villainy. And then there's the Mudges. This these wonderfully grotesque kind of clan. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about them and where they came from? Because am I right in thinking they're based upon some real people?
Yes. Well, so the Mudges are, there's a Mrs. Mudge and her four boys. They reveal themselves to be a pretty predatory group. Right. In ways that I really had fun writing. When I was looking for inspiration for them, we had a set of neighbors whose name is not that far off in like tone to the Mudges, who my mother and I and my sister and my grandmother, we hated them like we've probably never hated anyone, like so viscerally. They were such awful neighbors. And I just said, oh, that's... it's going to be them who are the crew, the Mudges, the crew who will be this like open, terrible set of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had so much fun with how awful they were.
They're delightfully awful. They're like Dickensian in their grotesquery.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I hoped that that's how they would come through. And yeah, like for a minute, I even considered like using the real family's name. And I was just like, nah, you don't want that lawsuit.
Yeah. So. Okay. I mean, they put me in mind of some real figures from kind of like the real Weird West. You know, like, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Bloody Benders who terrorized the Bloody Benders were this clan, the Bender family, although it turns out they possibly weren't related in the way that people thought they were. They owned a way station in Kansas in the 1870s, and there was the Ma and Pa Bender who were German and didn't speak any English or purported not to, and then there was Kate Bender, the daughter, and I can't remember the son's name. And there's lots of theories about how incestuous it was. It all gets very gothic, you know. And what basically, they had this way station and they would invite travelers to come in, and they had a big curtain at the head of the table, and they would, a big oilcloth curtain, and they would sit the traveler down at the head of the table, feed him stew, and as he took his first bite, one of the Benders would emerge from behind the curtain with a hammer, crack the guy's skull open, he'd drop immediately through a trapdoor into the basement, and that's how they subsisted for years in Kansas.
Jeez.
What I mean about the Weird West. Like, I love these stories of kind of weirdly gothic things that sound more fictional than the fiction, you know, but it's all out there. And that's exactly the tone that I think you hit with the Mudges, that they're really creepy in how far they are from like normal human conduct.
Right. Right. Yeah. And as you say, like, even as you were telling that story, I could hear the relish in your voice, right? Like, as you're relaying these awful details, and certainly now I'm going to have to go read up on them because they sound amazing. And I did feel like, you know, there's a lot of characters in here that I hope readers might love or care for or this and that. But I was like, well, we got to have some feral people too. You know, we got to have some just rough folks. And then the fun was like, but even there, it won't be who you would expect.
And also, they aren't entirely as you'd expect all the way through, because for certain characters, this is a book filled with at least offers of second chances. And yes. And it's funny that you said these are based on real people, because you do extend an olive branch. And I think you must be a much more forgiving person than me, Victor, because you let some of these people have better outcomes than I would be willing to.
Only in the final draft.
Oh, okay.
It was not always the case. But like at a certain point, my editor was like, this is just an abattoir. Like this is too much. You just can't kill everybody and relish it so much. So what could we do to complicate this a little bit? Because that like in earlier passes, like it was such a bloodier book. But without nuance, if mm-hmm. I can say. Like yeah. It was a lot of fun, but at a certain point it was just sort of like, so who else's limbs are coming off? Okay. Sure. You know, and with time I also started to realize that as I was going through drafts of the book, I was also, it's true, like starting to feel differently about okay. like, you know, like in the beginning, say with the Mudges, I had a sort of one size fits all feeling for them. But the more time I spent revising the book, the more times I was just like, well, but how did they start all this? And mm-hmm. like, they weren't just born evil. And then all of a sudden I started to have a different feeling about Mrs. Mudge. And then even more like about the boys, like, okay, well, you know, how much free will do you have if you're raised in a certain way?
Yeah.
Like, and then that led to certain choices that I think hopefully come across as a little more forgiving or nuanced than the original take.
Well, I mean, also this, please take this the right way, because this is not a criticism, but
yeah.
The final end of this book.
Yes.
Is for the characters that we care about. I yes. don't think it's a spoiler to say it's a happy ending.
And it is.
It's a happy ending that is almost more optimistic than the book implies yeah. it could possibly be, you know?
Right, right.
Particularly for one character who by that point, you know, well, the monster, shall we say, by that point, you're really, your heart is just wanting certain things to, certain outcomes. And you give yes. us those outcomes. And did you ever get any pushback in that regard that you were being too nice or too optimistic?
Well, you know, again, I would say the earlier drafts were much grimmer, much less hopeful. I think in a way, like more quote unquote realistic,
mm-hmm.
meaning like, but in a way, like I would say more in keeping with what one expects might be the cost for certain things that happen,
mm-hmm.
right? But the way I tried to balance it was like, if I told this, the real story about this, like based, if you go back to the actual history, it's so grim, it would be soul destroying.
Yeah.
Right. And so my feeling was like, okay, if I'm going to be truly realistic, and if I'm going to be, and like thinking about the modern day equivalents of stuff, like, you know, by and large, powerful people never pay for the things they do, and powerless people pay in every way, regardless of their goodness.
Hmm.
That's like, if we say broadly speaking, that's how the world really does shake out. And I just really wasn't in the mood for writing that. At a certain point, I said, if I make the cost high enough, maybe I can justify that in this fantasy, because in the end, that's what it is. That in this fantasy, they paid a lot in these different ways, but they got good. They got more than they could have hoped for in the mm-hmm. end. Maybe that can feel like, even if there's a moment of like, man, that really worked out, you could say like, well, but it wasn't easy. And that was my hope. So yeah, it was just the feeling of like, well, I'm not going to do the pure realist thing. In particular, like if we were talking about much earlier, the real history of the kind of these kinds of women, looking at popular entertainment and looking at general history, is that these women were just wiped out or sent running. That's it. You know? And I couldn't do that to him. I just couldn't, you know.
Speaking of, I suppose, getting what you deserve, it seems you are, because it says in the intro letter from your publicity team that a lot of your fiction is being adapted, which I think you more than deserve. Can you give us any details on that? The Changeling will be on Apple Plus, I believe, starring Lakeith Stanfield, is the latest I read.
That's right. That's right. It's we've shot the first season, and we're in post production now. I'm saying we only because to my great joy, I got to be much more woven into the process than maybe a lot of writers get. I was part of the shooting in New York for 5 weeks, and then in Toronto for 3 months. I was on set every day. I was helping the showrunner in whatever ways I could, learning a ton and getting to watch them make this thing that is, I mean, I know I'm biased, but I really do think it's going to be amazing.
When does it come out?
I don't think they have a specific date yet, but I'm imagining it'll be this fall. Just because that's a good spooky season.
Yeah. And that's to look forward to. What about your other books? Will Lone Women get an adaptation?
Yes. So we sold that a couple, maybe 6 months ago. I don't know if I'm allowed to say where yet, but one of the cool streamers, one of the fun streamers. and I'm adapting that. Like I've written the pilot. We have an amazing director who's attached to do the pilot, and then a wonderful actress as Adelaide. We're trying to develop that and trying to turn it into a season. And then Devil in Silver, I'm making that for AMC, and we've had a writer's room. We've written it would be a limited series. Sorry, I'm going all over. It would be a limited horror series for them, 6 episodes mm-hmm. to tell the whole story. The writer's room is closed. We've written 5 out of the 6 scripts already. The 6th one will be written relatively soon. I'm hoping that they'll move forward with it. Like we're waiting to get the green light to start filming. And if that goes, then we would film it this summer.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I'm hoping, and I really, I got to say, like you were saying, that was your first intro to me. I really think we took like whatever's the best of that book and then added in some, like since it's TV and all the rest, added in some, I think will be a lot of like really fun, painful, surprising horror.
Yeah, because that's a scary book. Like, I think more than others I've read, that is the scary book. Yeah. Excellent.
I hope so.
All good news. Well, speaking of books, I love when I can segue into this. Can you can you recommend a book, Victor, for my listeners and tell us why?
Yeah, so the book that I would recommend is not traditionally a horror book, but I think it's a horror novel. It's called The Autobiography of My Mother by Jamaica Kincaid. And the horror of it, so literally the first paragraph of the book, the narrator's mother dies giving birth to her, but she's kind of aware of it as she's being born. And she has this amazing phrase that I would butcher if I tried to quote it exactly, but this idea that like, because her mother dies when she's born, she has the line she uses something like, I had no one to protect me from the bleak black wind of eternity. And then you essentially, it's just a horror novel in the sense that it's about this young woman who's in the world without what we normally think of, obviously not always, but we normally think of as the protective veil of a mother.
Mm.
And then you just watch her just trying to stumble through existence, and the ways that she's sort of preyed upon by the world, because in a sense the world knows she has no champion.
Well, there you are, Victor. We started by sort of splitting horror and the literary, and then you've sutured it back together again with
Jamaica
Kincaid. Yeah, excellent. That was an unexpected addition to the reading list, but I will stick that in the show notes as I always do. Thanks for that.
And the writing is beautiful. The writing is beautiful and painful and powerful.
Of course, so. Yeah. I've read her essays. I've never read any of her novels or her fiction. I've read a lot of her essays for a course.
This is the one, I think.
But, okay. Good to know. Well, last question. What truly scares you, Victor Lavelle?
Well, so we talked earlier about how one of the ideas of the book is this idea of like caretaking, right? Let's say across in the broadest sense, and how in any family, some people are born with issues that make their lives more difficult. And then the very next sibling, the very next blood family member, whatever it is, skates past that problem that has hit this other person so hard. And so I realized like one of the things that scares me deeply is, for lack of better terms, like the capriciousness of fate or God or whatever we want to call it. Like how or why some people get hit so hard with the hammer of fate, and why some people in the same family skirt by, relatively speaking, without a blemish, without harm. No one can understand it, right? It's the roll of those dice, but it seems so terrible to me that it is really in the end just some big genetic or fate or God rolling dice and determining existence for a person, harder or easier. And it's the kind of thing that is, to me, so deeply frightening that it almost makes me want to believe in the absolute cliche I hate the most, which is that all things happen for a reason. Because I like to believe, like, in fact, I always feel like the only people who say things happen for a reason are the people who came out all right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you would never fucking say that if you just got a bad hand in some way.
Yeah, it's like, what goddamn reason is there for this?
What reason could there be? Yeah, exactly. Like, I really loathe that one, because I just think, like, I just don't agree. I just think sometimes things happen, and unfortunately, you have to figure out a way to deal with them. And so then that leads to, there's nothing controlling our existence, and that's terrifying. So that scares me.
Well, and listeners, if you read Lone Women, you will see that sentiment given horrific, heartbreaking flight. So yeah. Well, what a place to finish.
What an upbeat place to finish.
Yeah, I always ask that question last, and it's quite difficult to kind of just smooth and slide to a breezy end.
Yeah.
This has been a wonderful conversation. I feel like we've been all over the map, but in the best possible way. The book is out March 28th, which is a week from today, if you listen to this on the day this goes live. But for now, thank you for talking scared.
It's my absolute pleasure, man. This was a real blast.
Sometimes on this show, a conversation just flows effortlessly and somehow still manages to sound as constructed as if we'd planned it that way. To me, that's how this episode felt. It feels like Victor and I saw eye to eye on a lot of things, not least the inherent weirdness of the West, the way things never seem to change, and the heartbreak of monsters. It felt like a real meeting of the minds, although I think his mind is much more ordered and brilliant than mine. I love Victor's genre fiction, especially when it intersects with history. The Ballad of Black Tom is a masterwork. And whilst, for me, Lone Women doesn't quite hit those same incredible heights, it's still a fascinating look at a time in history that is severely misrepresented in fiction and film. And when you meet the thing in the box, you'll feel all the feelings. There aren't enough weird westerns, actually. There just aren't enough. I tried to articulate what I love about the genre, and I still came short. It's ineffable. I won't try again here. I've got other authors on the show later in the year who are playing in the same wheelhouse, not least C.S. Humble, who's writing a whole trilogy of weird westerns called The Light Sublime. And there's also a novel called Red Rabbit by Alex Grecian that's out in October that sounds both quite funny and quite horrific, a bit Joe Lansdale maybe. I don't quite know yet, but I hope I have a chance to discuss both and maybe refine my thoughts on why the Old West is just so fucking creepy. Some of my favourite examples are cinematic. High Plains Drifter comes to mind, but the absolute Mac Daddy, first time anyone said that since the 90s, is Bone Tomahawk. If you haven't seen Bone Tomahawk, then get to it right away. It's a Tarantino-esque spin on John Ford's The Searchers that will make you kind of laugh and cheer for 2 hours. Then it turns into the most depraved, horrific exploitation movie for the last 30 minutes. There's a scene in there that some people count amongst the most nauseating things they've ever seen. Now, I'm lucky because that particular thing didn't bother me. Though the first time I saw the movie as a whole, it left me with this weird feeling in my stomach, like I'd peered behind the veil at something dark and grim that I wasn't supposed to see. It's a really odd feeling that I've only ever had once before when I was watching Eden Lake, which is another phenomenal, nasty horror movie, though not a weird western. Anyway, I digress. Over to you. Do you like weird westerns? What are your favourite examples? And can you do better than me at defining why the subgenre works so well? You can get in touch via email on talkingscaredpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter or Instagram or TikTok at TalkScaredPod. I'm trying to drum up a few more Instagram followers this week to tip over the 1,000 mark. So if you're on there, give the show a follow. Reviews, as mentioned, are the lifeblood of indie podcasting. And if you leave one, you get missed off the mass curse this week. As for those who do want more Talking Scared, there's the Patreon. Again, it's patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. Or use the link in the show notes. A few quid a month gets you loads of regular bonus stuff and a back catalogue of over 40 hours. Right. You know, I have really loved bringing this show to you in 2023. The calibre of guests has been excellent, I think. Grady Hendrix, Stephen Graham Jones, Margaret Atwood. And there's plenty more to come, from big names to emerging talent. And I'll also be devoting May to catching up with a few books that I missed in 2022 and a few indie authors. Looking forward to that. I'll post a list of guests and you can perhaps catch up with some reading before those episodes come out. Next week, I'm back with Max Booth III to really fuck your shit up. His new collection is called Abnormal Statistics and it is heavy stuff. Trigger warnings needed, methinks, but it's about as much fun as you can have reading about torture and loneliness and dead kids and sucking other people's teeth. Yeah, look forward to that. Until then, head west, pack warm clothes for the journey, and in the words of my grandmother, if you can't fight, wear a big hat. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.